This is Continental Media 0701, also known later as World of Radio Extra 75. Thanks to everyone who's been asking me what's become of Continental Media. We've taken a rest for a few months, but this first edition of 2007 is now being produced in early June. Continental Media is made possible by Universal Radio. For a catalog, go to www.universal-radio.com or phone them at 1-800-431-3939. Universal also sponsors www.dxing.com, where you'll find much more information, including access to this program. Continental Media is about media around the American continent, not especially shortwave. This edition will deal primarily with U.S. international broadcasting and with the situation in Venezuela. The Media Network blog quoted a source called Narinjara on May 21st that the Radio Free Asia Burmese service has launched a 5-minute-long Arakanese language service during its ethnic program. News in Arakanese is aired towards the end of the RFA Burmese program every Sunday at 12:30 to 13:30 on 9320-9455 and 13675. And the RFA Burmese service will also launch a MON, M-O-N, language section. Other language programs have been airing on RFA's service since last year: Shan, Karen, Kareni, Kachin, and Chin. And they say another Arakanese program from the Democratic Voice of Burma, based in Norway, also airs every Sunday. Seems to me that these minority language programs are generally lumped together under Burmese. They're not even mentioned in the Radio Free Asia frequency schedules. We still don't have the exact days and times for them. What an insult, I think. And they do the same thing with Chinese minority languages. Just to be sure, I'm not criticizing Radio Free Asia unjustly. I went to their website, www.rfa.org, and searched the site for Arakanese, and it was unfound, no reference to it whatsoever. And there's no mention, as I said, of minority languages in the overall frequency schedule. However, I suppose Arakanese and the others might be mentioned somewhere in the Burmese language text. Zaharias Liangas forwarded us a long story called Radio Sawa, America's New Adventure in Radio Broadcasting. It appeared in Arab Media Society, written by Sam Hilmy, H-I-L-M-Y. I'll just quote a few excerpts and recommend that you read the whole thing. According to its founders, Radio Sawa was designed to report the news straight up so listeners could decide for themselves. In April 2002, the U.S. government launched an audacious new Arabic language station aimed at the Middle East and North Africa. The round-the-clock broadcast, oddly dubbed Radio Sawa, replaced at a single stroke the respected brand name of the Voice of America's Arabic service, which had for over a half century in war and peace provided the region with comprehensive full-service programming. A predominantly pop music service designed to appeal to youth, Sawa was established at the behest of American commercial media mogul Norman Pattiz, who until his resignation at the end of 2006 was a member of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, an independent federal agency. The BBG oversees all non-military U.S. government-funded broadcast outlets. To run the new station, the BBG, under Chairman Kenneth Tomlinson, a former chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, editor of Reader's Digest, and director of the VOA, who also recently abandoned his government position under a cloud of criticism for mismanagement, Tomlinson founded and funded the Middle East Broadcasting Networks, MBN, a non-profit corporation. MBN also operates Sawa's younger twin Arabic TV satellite channel, Al Hura. Tomlinson publicly described his friend and colleague, Mr. Pattiz, as the father of Radio Sawa. After the station was launched, Pattiz described it in a public forum ecstatically. It sounded so different and was so appealing because it really sounds like a Western contemporary music station, a pop station. After conducting surveys, Pattiz decided there was a hole in the marketplace, and in order to fill this hole with his product, Radio Sawa, he needed ample sources of cash and the most modern broadcast facilities. The new station cost the American taxpayer $34 million in its first year. He secured clear FM transmission to most Arab countries and a powerful medium wave to the rest. The VOA's Arabic service cost the U.S. government less than $5 million annually and transmitted its programs on a limited medium wave and a few short waves at the time it was replaced by Sawa. The writer does not point out, but I do, that Sawa subsequently abandoned shortwave completely. At this point, I should skip to an explicatory footnote. All the analyses, assessments, evaluations, and judgments included in the study of Radio Sawa's programs are based on extensive first-hand personal listening to the American station's broadcasts. The author's conclusions were reached after continual off-air spot monitoring of Sawa's Arabic airtime. Random sample listening covered most hours of day and night since the station's establishment. And I also must interject this, that Sawa has several variations for different target areas, but the author never goes into this. He refers to a program called Iraq and the World, which is a 30-minute news program, unlike most of their much shorter newscasts. And I wonder, is that program on all the variations or just the one to Iraq? Anyhow, he says Sawa's constant on-air slogan boasts about the loveliest tunes and the latest news. It never identifies itself as an American station or where it broadcasts from. Its round-the-clock airtime is divided into roughly 20% news and 80% pop music. Everything the listener hears, other than the music, is called The World Now. No news-related material ever interrupts or is incorporated within the music portion, no matter how urgent the breaking news. Sawa does not carry discrete identifiable programs with distinct titles, individual star talent and performers, music themes, and thematic focus. No news bulletins are heard alerting listeners to momentous world events. The station's studio readers, anchor persons, and host announcers are never identified by name. Contrary to Mr. Pata's claim, Sawa never carries headlines at the top and bottom of the hour. It provides news only twice every hour, usually 5 minutes every quarter after the hour, and a minute or two of headlines every quarter before the hour. The five-minute segments are variously called newscast or full newscast or detailed newscast. The full-length news may occasionally run up to 10, 15, or even 30 minutes, as in the case of the daily Iraq and the World. A fair and generous average would be 10 minutes per hour, bringing the total news time in a 24-hour cycle to 240 minutes, less than half the 600-minute daily claim made by Sawa officials in media interviews. Well, this goes on at great length and in great detail, but I think you get the drift. He generally finds Sawa wanting. And furthermore, since it is not the voice of America, it is not subject to the VOA charter, which requires accurate, objective, and comprehensive news. Well, there's a complaint from without U.S. International Broadcasting, but there are also complaints from within. The following items are from the website of the union representing VOA workers, AFGE Local 1812. Assistant Secretary of State for Public Diplomacy, Karen Hughes, remember her, looked like a deer caught in the inquisitive headlights of the House Subcommittee on Appropriations, chaired by New York Congresswoman Nita Lowey, where she testified, I believe it was back in April. A majority of the subcommittee seemed incredulous as Ms. Hughes time and again defended the decision to eliminate English broadcasts on radio. Why would you want to do that? One subcommittee member after another asked, to which she offered no good explanation. Pardon us, Ms. Hughes, but other international broadcasters don't see it that way. Chinese government radio is expanding its news programming in English, along with Russian government radio, and even Al Jazeera, the Arabic language network, is broadcasting in English. And they are broadcasting to most regions of the world on shortwave radio. Surprised? It's darn near impossible to get a TV signal into a targeted region when there is no TV station that will broadcast it. It's darn near impossible to get an AM or FM signal into a targeted region when there are no affiliates allowed to carry it. In comparison, shortwave does marry the mission to the market because it gets to the market and cannot be easily blocked. With some shortwave radios now costing as little as $19, this should be a no-brainer. Then again, it's always been sexier to convince Congress to spend tens of megadollars on the latest boondoggle rather than on projects that give taxpayers their money's worth. Apparently, these other global broadcasters know something the BBG does not. English is the language of commerce around the world. English is the official language in 74 countries and the second language of choice in many others. English is spoken, written, or understood by 1.6 giga people in the world. If the BBG chooses to ignore the fact that this is one hell of a big potential audience and it shouldn't be ignored, can we honestly say they are good stewards of the taxpayers' money? In response to questions about BBG surveys that there's just no audience for English, Congresswoman McCollum stated rhetorically, "I know about your surveys. You turn off a transmitter to one area of the world and then asked after the fact if anybody's listening. That just doesn't make sense, Ms. Hughes, does it?" We don't think so either. Morale. It's something the BBG claims it is interested in improving, but actions speak much more eloquently than words. An example is that BBG treats its retired career employees as if they are potential criminals. Not long ago, after you retired from the agency, you were provided with a retiree badge allowing you to access the buildings where you spent the greater part of your professional life as if you were still an employee. You did not get a gold watch, but you did get that little bit of recognition. Now you're given a retiree badge that is essentially worthless. BBG has decided that retirees are potential criminals. We can understand employees who've left under a disciplinary cloud might pose a security risk, but not those who've retired voluntarily. They have gone through background checks and have been deemed fit for government service right up until the date of their retirement. Suddenly, the agency acts as if these people are complete strangers, lumping them into the same category as visitors. A visitor may need someone to vouch for him or her, someone who can testify to their character and need to enter the building. A visitor may need to be escorted. But to treat former colleagues in this manner, who've been coming to work for the past 15, 20, or 30 years, as if they were suddenly pariahs, is insulting and incomprehensible. One way to boost morale is for managers to recognize that VOA is in the communications business, and that means integrated radio, TV, and internet, and not in the business of perpetuating a top-heavy bureaucracy whose only job is to keep their jobs. And it seems that labor-management relations are worsening. This was dated May 30th. After several months of grueling negotiations over a new contract, it seems management has decided they no longer want to be bothered to continue bargaining. Instead, they have decided to press for an expedited bargaining process for the proposed upcoming RIFs, reductions in force. In other words, they're in a hurry to get rid of career employees. And then on June 1st, the IBB Chief of Labor Relations declared by fiat that negotiations over a new collective bargaining agreement between Local 1812 and the BBG are over until a federal mediator is called in. And then she offered to call in her personal acquaintance, Lynn Sylvester. Here's what happened, they say, when union negotiators provided a proposal that would prevent separation of career employees with more than 10 years of service based on a proposal in another union's contract, AFSCME 1418, and which was agreed to by BBG management. When that happened, the management team got furious, leading to a statement about feeding at the government trough. After some heated discussion, the agency declared unilaterally that the negotiations were over. You're listening to Continent of Media 0701. Your comments and input are welcome to P.O. Box 1684, ENID OK 73702 USA, or WORADIO at yahoo.com. Now some news about a couple of my favorite public radio stations in New Mexico, which I listen to when I'm visiting and listen to still when I'm far away via their webcasts. First, about KUNM in Albuquerque, an editorial by manager Richard S. Town in their monthly publication Zounds. In April, KUNM applied to the FCC to increase transmitting power from 13,000 to 18,500 watts. It's pending but should be granted shortly by the FCC, the final phase of our transmitter makeover at Sandia Crest. We have replaced the transmitter and the antenna, added digital transmission, and increased our power. Most folks will notice little impact from the power increase. Raising power does not mean we're going to be louder. It means our signal will reach more places than it did at the lower power. Now we'll operate at the maximum power permitted for our channel at Sandia Crest. Should improve reception in terrainous areas, that's a word he says I just made up, such as Tijeras Canyon. That's a dead area as you approach Albuquerque from the east on I-40, also at La Bajada and Tezuque. We would also see improved reception in some structurally dense areas, such as downtown offices, the Big I interchange of Interstates 25 and 40, the East Mountains, and in bomb shelters. The power increase will extend our broadcast radius a bit. We get to the east side of Grants, but the increase will get us 10 miles further west of Grants on I-40, and it should be reaching further into northern and central New Mexico. You should be pleased to know that you are listening to Public Radio's tallest transmission point in height above average terrain. In FM transmission, antenna height is critical, but that does not make us louder. In fact, KUNM is intentionally softer on your dial. Let me give you the lay version of why we like soft. And IGH think this no doubt applies to many other public radio stations. You will notice that when you switch between stations on your car radio, KUNM is noticeably softer in volume than other stations. If you dial up from us to KOB or KHFM, which is the commercial classical station, or Air America, the difference is quite discernible. KUNM uses far less electronic sound processing than any other station on the dial. We do this to give you the highest fidelity rather than the loudest overall signal on the dial. Some stations buy fancy electronic boxes, compressors, equalizers, sound processors to pump up the overall volume. This adds color to the sound, at times distorting the beauty of the voice or instrument to an unreal point. There's this decades-old macho concept in radio that louder is better. To be the loudest on the dial, you just pump up the bass, turn every whisper to a scream, and process the natural sound more than Wonder Bread processes the grain they grow. So we have abandoned the notion that louder is better. We give you the notion that we can provide a signal to you that is faithful to the artists, the musicians, the news anchors, poets, and producers. KUNM serves up a signal that is as faithful to the natural sound as we can possibly deliver. Compare a music passage on KUNM to any other on your radio dial, and you'll hear what we mean. We may be quieter, but fidelity is not a lost art, certainly not for us. As always, thanks for listening and supporting KUNM in Albuquerque. I spotted this brief and somewhat cryptic announcement on the website of KSFR, Santa Fe's public radio station, which does not transmit from Sandia Crest. In fact, it has a tower inside Santa Fe, not on a mountain at all. It says, happening now at KSFR, a bigger voice. KSFR soon will be heard over the air from Taos to Albuquerque, with a stronger signal throughout all of Santa Fe, Los Alamos, White Rock, Española, Placitas, Corrales, Rio Rancho, Bernalillo, and more. An official announcement is coming in June. That's all it says. Well, I looked at the end of May at their FCC information, and I did not find any application to increase power from only 3 kilowatts, or to increase its tower height, or move it to another location. So what are they talking about? Perhaps they're adding translators, but those were not listed under KSFR's file number. What they really need, if not a much higher power main transmitter, is a translator on Sandia Crest. But even that would not help much in Española. Anyhow, both of these stations are among our favorite webcasters, where transmitter location and power doesn't matter. In the June VHF-UHF Digest of the Worldwide TV-FM-DX Association, Doug Smith updates us on the digital TV transition. He says, contrary to what I'd expected, stations will be expected to vacate their interim DTV channels immediately on transition day. This will cause some interesting logistical issues for many stations. Those whose permanent DTV channels are different from their interim assignments will have to build a DTV facility on the new channel, but cannot test it on the air, they'd better hope it works, on February 17th. The FCC document, a huge one, suggests stations will be allowed to test their permanent DTV facilities in advance, but will often require careful cooperation of competing stations, which will be required to go off the air or at least accept serious interference for such testing to proceed. Another order disposed of 145 applications for additional time to complete DTV construction, and most of those were granted. Four stations in New York cited the 9/11 attack as grounds for extension. Hurricanes were cited by some stations in New Orleans. Five Denver stations had problems obtaining local approval for their antennas at the existing analog site. 21 TV stations do not have a DTV permit or license at this point. The report states there are roughly 18,700,000 homes that receive only over-the-air analog TV. Another 1,300,000 receive only over-the-air TV but have digital capability. These 18.7 mega homes have 44.2 mega analog sets. Another 23.5 mega TV sets in homes that have cable and satellite are not connected to the cable satellite service. Is that clear? Bill Hale notified members of the National Radio Club May 31st that the FCC has released their rulings on so-called in-band on-channel broadcasting. The much-awaited decision on nighttime IBOC on AM is approved and will become law in approximately 6 weeks, that means mid-July, or 30 days after the report appears in the Federal Register. Doug Smith elaborates on that in his American Bandscan blog. The biggest difference, listeners and especially DXers will notice, is that AM stations will be allowed to operate their so-called HD signals at night. Most of this is actually about FM, but AM stations that have already notified the FCC of their daytime use of IBOC need not perform further notification to begin nighttime operation. The U.S. is still in negotiations with Canada and Mexico. A Canadian engineer and DXer filed comments arguing that IBOC is prohibited under bilateral treaties with both countries. IBOC permits will contain a clause noting that they may be modified or revoked if international considerations require it. The Canadian referred to is, of course, Barry McLarnon, who argues that IBOC digital carriers extend the station's bandwidth to approximately 28 kilohertz, far outside that necessary and normally expected from an A3E, that is a regular analog AM signal. He also notes that an identical clause exists in the U.S.-Mexico agreement. And Doug Smith says, Barry is 100% right, but since when does the U.S. government listen to any other country when there's money to be made? Meanwhile, Radio World reports that Mexico will allow IBOC on border stations with the U.S. And furthermore, Broadcast Electronics announced that an AM HD radio demonstration had taken place in Mexico on May 26th. There's been a great deal of press about Hugo Chavez closing down the television network in Venezuela, which opposed him, Radio Caracas Televisión. Not really time to get into the back and forth of that from a political standpoint on this particular edition. But many items have appeared in DX Listening Digest recently about it from both sides, including from some commentators in Venezuela. But I would like to deal with some more or less technical issues this discussion has led to. On the Radio Scooters list, Manuel Jesus in Portugal forwarded a story published in Diario Digital enumerating the previous infractions of RCTV and things that it had had to put up with. For example, it was obliged by legislation between 1969 and 1974 to install a filter to decolorize its signal after it had already installed color television transmission capability. Joe Buck in Delaware says, don't blame the Venezuelans. The same thing happened in Canada. I got my first color TV in 1964, living near Montreal. We could receive color via cable from New York and New Hampshire and Vermont, U.S. affiliates. On Sunday evening, CBC took a feed of Bonanza directly from NBC, but CBC was not permitted by the government to telecast color programming. They deliberately rekeyed the horizontal sync pulses, so the color burst signal riding on the back porch of the sync signal was deleted. This would cause receivers to think the program was in black and white. However, a friend of mine pointed out that if one maladjusted the controls in the back of the receiver, one could see the glorious color of Bonanza. The only problem is that without the burst signal to lock the color demodulator to the transmitted signal, the colors would slowly shift through all the colors of the rainbow. Purple people were quite fun to watch and provided a drug-free psychedelic experience. Maybe they were getting off on the unsynced colors and thus saving a lot of money they would otherwise have to spend for drugs. And Ben Dawson adds something more to this. You may not be aware, but Venezuela had no FM broadcasting until the late 1980s. The original technical regulations was stamped into our library on January 11, 1985, and the Ministry of Transport and Communications issued technical instructions for FM stations dated February of 85. I don't believe there were licenses granted until about 1988. I made several trips to all the major cities in Venezuela, except Mérida and Ciudad Bolívar, from about 1985 to 89, on behalf of our firm's clients to locate and evaluate potential FM sites. Many of the TV sites were established for wide area coverage, assuming outdoor antennas, so they weren't necessarily suitable for FM. Up until the late 1980s, the only signals on FM were from low-power transmitters with simple antennas at in-city sites and with no baseband modulation, but only a background music subcarrier, one in each city, all operated countrywide by a single licensee. Speaking of wide coverage, RCTV on Channel 2 was my first and only double-hop TVDX catch many years ago and my only one from South America. With RCTV replaced by TVS, it'll be a new station if I ever catch Channel 2 from Venezuela again. In fact, I have a verification letter from RCTV in my collection for reception on May 30th, 1968. It's the latest addition to my small QSL gallery, which you're invited to peruse at worldofradio.com. Venezuela, patria del expropiador. Glenn Hauser concluding Continent of Media 0701 with a standard disclaimer. Hope you've enjoyed the show, also known later as World of Radio Extra 75.